Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
Hello, and welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, episode 172. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Thrillers.
Mysteries.
And there's crime.
And suspense.
There's a long pregnant pause there.
No, it was called suspense.
Oh, you were putting the listeners in suspense.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, you know, regular listeners need to be reminded every week. I need to be reminded every week of the four genres that we publish.
Yes.
But welcome to the show. And our guest this week is Alison Stockham, who returns to us. And we spoke to her last, I think it was July.
It was summer, yeah, definitely.
And
she's quick at writing.
She is, yes. So we're celebrating her third novel out.
About a month ago, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely, now? Yeah. But fascinating. I mean, there's many changes in her life between now and then, so we talk about that.
Yeah, and the sort of things she's learnt along the way, process, and yeah, it's a very interesting discussion.
It is, and yeah, she's a lively interview, so really enjoyed it. So Alison Stockham is our guest this week. We'll speak to her a little bit later. So news-wise, a really mega one. Now, this is...
Not about AI,
it's not at all. But there's no question that one of the most divisive issues around worldwide, without question, are the events Israel and Gaza at the moment. And it has reached very firmly into the publishing world. This week, there was an extraordinary general meeting of the Society of Authors.
Can you just explain what that means, extraordinary general meeting?
Well, what happened on this occasion, I mean, extraordinary general meetings are called when... for instance, within an organisation, a particular part of it makes demands that the leadership of that organisation decide needs to be put to the membership, so they called a general meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And it was done online. There was an online vote. And the reason they were voting was on two resolutions called by a new pressure group which has emerged in recent months. The campaign group called Fossil Free Books, or FFB, submitted two motions to the Society of Authors, which of course is the largest trade union for writers, illustrators and translators, which triggered an extraordinary general meeting on Thursday night. Members voted 1,480 votes to 251 in favour of the first, which called for the publishing industry to divest from ties with the fossil fuels industry and calls for the book industry to break ties with investment firm Baillie Gifford, which sponsors the UK's most prestigious non-fiction prize and a number of literary festivals. And that began after Greta Thunberg pulled out of her scheduled appearance at the Edinburgh Book Festival last year. Since then, FFB was formed, and a number of authors have continued to speak out against Baillie Gifford, which has a proportion of its investments in corporations that profit from fossil fuels. But the second, which was narrowly defeated, called for the Society of Authors to issue a statement saying it supported an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The motion called for a statement to be released to the effect that the Society of Authors condemns indiscriminate targeting of civilians and cultural infrastructure, including churches, mosques, hospitals, schools, libraries and universities. The Society of Authors calls for an immediate and permanent ceasefire and for Israel to uphold its obligation under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And then it also pointed out that at least 95 journalists and media workers have been killed as a consequence of Israeli military action since October the 7th, 2023. Writers at risk of harassment and obstruction while evacuating Gaza is of serious concern. Now, the management committee of the Society of Authors added a note to the proposal saying it opposed the resolution because it did not feel the organisation should issue a collective statement on issues that are outside our remit and expertise and where we have no mandate from our membership.
Yeah, you see, that was my first reaction. When you just read the second part of the story, say, the Gaza thing, I thought, what's the connection? A, what's the connection between the Society of Authors and political events? And also, what weight do they carry? They can issue a statement to say anything. But...
Well, I think the issue at the moment is that it doesn't matter what the organisation is, everyone's been demanded for which, depending which side, it doesn't matter which side actually of the debate you're on. Basically, everyone is demanding people to take a stance, that you cannot stand aside and let these things happen, is the argument.
But you're not stopping these things happening by making a statement.
No, indeed. But it is about making a, you know, in this area of argument, debate and concern, it is about, you know, you cannot be, there are people within the organisation, in this case, the FFB, saying you cannot stand aside while all these things are happening. And I take your point that you can argue, what is the voice of the Society of Authors going to do to change the situation? Not very much. But their argument would be, well, you can't, you know, just doing nothing isn't good enough.
But they're not doing something. Making a statement is not an active...
I appreciate that. But then, you know, we're now going into the whole debate about, you know, gesture politics and all sorts of, things that are drawing, you know, division into everything in society because of what's been going on. Now, let me just fill out the details of what happened. The electronic ballot, which was conducted during the online meeting, saw 786 members vote for the motion that the Society of Authors should release a statement condemning Israel, and 883 against, with a further 239 abstentions. So just under 100 vote difference. But the Society of Authors prevailed in a way, the leadership, and, you know, it was the motion to do this statement was opposed. And this has now caused a number of voices on the pro-Palestinian side of the debate to speak out against the Society of Authors and take action in a number of ways. So, I mean, I have some sympathy for the situation for the Society of Authors.
I have a lot of sympathy.
Yes. I mean, this article, which is actually in The Guardian, which goes into great detail, provides an example. Among those who voted against the resolution was the author Hilary Freeman, whose next book in August is a children's retelling of Tova Friedman's Holocaust memoir entitled Daughter of Auschwitz. Freeman, who lost a family member in the Hamas kibbutz attacks on the 7th of October, said the resolution was too one-sided. It didn't mention Hamas or October the 7th at all. It didn't mention the hostages. If it had condemned Hamas as well as Israel and called for a peaceful resolution, it might have had more support. As it was, I just found it very offensive. And Freeman then consulted the group UK Lawyers for Israel with a view to mounting a legal challenge against the Society of Authors releasing a statement if the motion was carried, saying it was against the SOA's remit. She said, despite letters from barristers, the SOA still went ahead with the vote. Freeman, who said she was not a supporter of Benjamin Netanyahu or the Israeli government, but considered herself a Zionist because she believes the existence of an Israeli state, I think the fact that more than 200 people abstained shows how uncomfortable people were with it.
Yeah, so that would be my position. I would probably abstain.
Yes.
Because it does. It makes you feel uncomfortable thinking about it.
Yeah. And then the Society of Authors have further said, you know, Vanessa Fox O'Loughlin, who is the chair of the board of the Society of Authors, said it's important to note that the Resolution 3 vote was on whether or not the SOA should publish a statement. It was not, as some have claimed, a vote on whether or not the SOA membership is for or against a ceasefire.
That's very important, yeah.
We are a democratic organisation and our members will always hold a wide range of views and disagree on issues, which means that, as in this case, the staff, team and board need to navigate the fine line between them. And there was a further motion, which right at the bottom, we're going to go to AI. During the EGM, members also voted in favour of a further motion put forward by the Society of Authors Management Committee, asserting that they do not consent to the use of their works being used to develop generative artificial intelligence systems. And in many ways, it's a shame that...
Overshadowed, yeah.
Overshadowed by, you know, this, you know, sort of intractable debate over Israel and Gaza and the current situation. And, you know, it takes me back to my time at the BBC because very, very occasionally I had a programme that I was responsible for called World Football. And there were some... We did some stories which were alarming, to say the least, about the way that Palestinian footballers were interned on their, you know, they were playing in the Israeli league, but going back to, you know, Gaza or wherever it might be, the West Bank. And on their crossing of that border and divide, would get arrested and interned. And in some cases, there were allegations of torture. And these were professional footballers playing for Israeli teams. And I remember every time we did anything on that subject, no matter how balanced the piece was, we got absolutely slews of mail from both sides of this divide and this debate. And you just could not argue, you know, the demand is that an organisation like the BBC should be very firmly on one side or the other, depending on who the correspondent was. That, you know, there's no line you can take down the middle.
You say that. I don't understand that. I thought the BBC was supposed to be impartial.
Well, exactly. But when you're arguing that that's what we tried to achieve, and, you know, you would balance it with stories about Israeli football, which was impacted by, you know, I don't know, terrorist activity or rocket attacks or something like that, you know, somewhere down the line, that would be, you know, there was no... The debate is so polarised and so divisive that it doesn't matter how you treat a story or do, you know, I would just say to the team, look, I just don't think we should be doing these stories because I personally cannot spend the next month unpicking and responding to the amount of trouble it's going to cause, even though these are very, very important stories that need to be reflected.
But
you'd probably
get backfire for not reporting a story, though, wouldn't
you?
Well,
you know, there's always choices. The nature of being impartial at the BBC, which is, you know, some people will be listening to this and laughing at me for suggesting that it is, but, you know, and to some extent, that impartiality has been eroded in recent years because when I first joined, we were really, really, the rigour with which we applied impartiality was and standing aside from offering opinion was really very strong in the 90s. Mm-hmm. It was sort of legacy of the earlier times. And that is less so now. There's far more opinion being expressed by BBC staffers on areas of enormous contention than ever before.
Well, that's the rise of social media, isn't it? They've got that platform where they can express their individual opinions.
Well, there's that element, which was always my bugbear, which was, you know, you turn around to senior reporters, even in sport, and say, hang on a second. So you thought your number one priority was to tell your Twitter audience about this breaking story before you actually phoned the office to let us know about it. And that was, that used to drive me nuts. And you're being paid by the BBC to be the editor, correspondent, whatever it is, with this inside knowledge. And the first people who hear about it are your Twitter audience, which admittedly is quite big, at 250,000 or something like that. But that's more important to you, and you know, from an ego point of view, than it is actually to do your job and let us know in the office that there's a story breaking. And that used to drive me nuts. And that is without question, the social media revolution has eroded journalistic values to such an extent that as somebody brought up 25 years earlier in the the school of absolute, well, we've got to reflect the opinion of and the position of such and such opposition. You know, you can't just take the story from this angle.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very, very difficult. And those arguments were just daily, minute to minute or sometimes.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Anyway, so the Society of Authors drawn into that and, had to go to the trouble of an emergency general meeting and fascinating development, really. But it just goes to show that I think the more worrying trend is that campaign organisations want to start pushing something like the Society of Authors into positions which it really has no position taking, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just one of it's. It kind of makes me feel. It just makes me feel upset more than anything else. Just sad.
Yeah. But increasingly, that's the polarity of the world, isn't it? I'm sorry, I'm eating some chocolate now. It's very unprofessional. How dreadful.
Yeah, and you're the professional.
Yes, I keep reminding you. I used to be. Anyway, second story is an observation from something that I was doing this week. Now, I was setting up some Amazon advert campaigns for some of our books, which I always do with some trepidation because they're really hard to make work.
Yeah. Yeah, we haven't quite reached a sweet spot yet.
No, very difficult to achieve. And there are so many different things that come into play. But one thing that struck me was when I was doing, for those who are familiar with Amazon ads, you'll know what I'm talking about. But essentially, in the UK, we get two main channels in which to advertise through the KDP, that's the Kindle Direct Publishing dashboard. One is called Sponsored Products, which is for an individual book, and then there are Sponsored Brands. So if an author has three titles, of which we have a number, then you can create advertising which talks about, you can put
I see them all the time, for Simon Retrieve.
Exactly, and you can put the multiple images of the titles in a banner.
They appear at the top, don't they?
Yeah, and they are... again, they're a different beast to the
sponsor. They don't persuade me to buy books, I can tell you that.
But they can be effective. Anyway.
Apparently, yes.
Yes, but until now, you had two options when you were setting those up. One was to have that your own internal creative where you created an image and came up with your tagline and all that stuff. And in the past, you could just simply put together a very plain version of that and advertise the books. Now, Amazon are saying that from the end of this month, or a week before the end of this month, sponsored brand adverts have to have creative imagery and taglines and all that malarkey created. You cannot now run them plain, if you like. And I don't know quite how that is going to impact. I mean, their argument is, and as ever with Amazon, when they say something, they change the way they operate, they don't explain themselves terribly well. It's a single paragraph. It's extremely confusing. There's no, there are no examples of what they mean. There's even when you click on learn more, it tells you really very little.
Very Amazon.
But that will be of interest and an impact for independent authors, I'm sure. But I think the ones that have been successful using sponsored brands are already doing this. But again, it's another one of these things where you have to do lots of split testing to figure out which of your bits of creative works best. And that's always the problem with this. Digital advertising really is still reliant on you being creating different versions, running them concurrently and spending a lot of money doing so, and then figuring out what's working best and switching off the bits that aren't. And it's that interpretation, that almost an instinct sometimes for some people, that differentiates between success and failure, and very expensive failure at times.
Because expensive success.
Yes.
So
very hard to make these things work profitably.
No.
Anyway, so that is that's another change that Amazon have brought in. Okay, let's move on to our interview with Alison Stockham. Alison, if you remember, you may have heard the interview that we did with her back last July, is based in Cambridge, and we were talking to some extent about her work with the Cambridge Literary Festival. Mm. She's now left that job, actually, and going full-time. So that's the big news, is that as an author, success is such that she has got some other things going on which she couldn't talk about, but essentially she's going to be a full-time author.
Yeah, so immersing herself in the writing world, I think, is sort of similar to how she described it. So yeah, she's a writer.
She is, and this is a really good exploration of process in this interview with Alison Stockham. Welcome back, Alison Stockham.
Thank
Welcome back
much.
To the show.
Nice to see you again.
Yeah, it is nice to see you too. And for listeners who will remember, perhaps who are new to us as well, we spoke to you back in July last year. And correct me if I'm wrong, how many books did you have out at that point? Was it the one? Was it the
July
two?
July was my second book. So I had The Chicken Sister out in February, The Silent Friend out in July, and then now I have The New Girl out in April.
Yeah,
we should make this a tradition then, shouldn't we?
Yeah, every podcast every 9 months I'll pop up and be like, hi.
So The New Girl, welcome to the world, The New Girl, which came out a couple of weeks ago or so. How's it going?
Good, yeah. It's really interesting seeing how this one's being received, because it's kind of got elements of the first book, it's got elements of the second book, and it is also its own thing. And it's also the idea for this one has been in my head for 30 years.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Well, or at least the opening bit of it. I didn't know what I wanted to do with it, but I knew I wanted to do something with it.
Oh, you might have to tell us a bit more about the opening.
The opening idea? Well, is it the image? I mean, the one that stands out from what I've seen, the image of a baby scan being pushed through the letterbox. Was that your starting point?
Yeah, it happened to somebody I knew when I was a teenager who discovered that her husband was cheating on her when the other woman posted the baby scan through the front door, having got tired of waiting for the guy to tell his wife. She decided to do it.
That's a good way to do it.
And I was I was torn on one hand because she was a wonderful person and I was absolutely enraged on her behalf that two people could treat her so badly. But also my writer brain was like, oh, that's a good opening for something, isn't it? Like, what could you do with that? So where the story's gone is different to what happened in reality. And I kind of went, what would happen if, and what if we did that, and who's this, and bringing in all these other elements. And then I remember I used to do temp work in offices when I was breaking into film and TV, and I just kind of temped around short-term contracts. And I was in this office where the boss's wife was convinced that I was after her husband. So they would be in a meeting and I would be like the temp admin assistant. So when the phone rang, I would answer it because I wasn't in the meeting. And she would be like, who are you? Why are you answering his phone? Where is he? Why are you in his office? And I'd be like, because they're all in a meeting and I'm here to man the phones because that's my job. But I thought, what if I put those two elements together and brought that paranoia into the workplace?
It's
interesting, yeah.
It's a very believable scenario.
Because I did temping as well, went to break into publishing. Mm-hmm. So I can remember what it's like being the temp and also being the one not in the meeting, but looking after everything while the meeting was going ahead.
I remember three things about that job. One was this woman who was just, she should randomly turn up, but she was checking on me. And her husband was nice enough, but I was 19. He was like 50. And it's just like, I'm glad that you think your husband is such a catch, but trust me, you don't need to worry about it. But also, I remember bringing in a box of chocolates because it was my birthday. And then I went to the bathroom or to make a cup of tea. When I came back, the team had opened them and started them without me. And I was just like, that's a bit rude.
That's terrible. That's mean.
It's mean, isn't it? And then it was not being invited to the work Christmas party. Everybody else in the whole building went. Not that I particularly wanted to go, because it was like a corporatey thing, but
it's just the principle, isn't it?
It was a bit like, okay, I'll stay here and man the phones
and do the photocopying.
It's just like, I'll never be able to steal your husband. I'm never invited to any of the same places.
Yeah, so no mistletoe snogging.
Yeah, oh, no. But no, so taking that kind of the paranoia of, you know, the new person in the workplace and what they represent and what are their real motives, and then combining that with this who sent the baby scan, what's that all about, and then kind of really ramping up when you get an idea in your head and you're convinced of something and you basically drive yourself slightly crazy trying to either prove it or disprove it. That's the central theme of The New Girl.
Yeah, because you see signs, but that, well, you see things that could be signs and you add them all together, don't you? And they become the story that you think is the truth. Yeah, it's interesting.
It's like, does 2 and 2 equal 4, or is it 27? Is she right? Is she not right? Okay, I'm not going to tell you.
Well, I think you know, everyone listening to this will probably have been in a situation where they've either been the subject of that suspicion or have witnessed at least.
Or know someone. Or,
yeah. I mean, I've witnessed this in all sorts of workplaces. Less so in the BBC. I don't know why. I mean,
I was going to say, I would have thought that'd be a hotbed for all this sort of suspicion, paranoia.
Well, my time in the BBC, I saw quite a lot of sneaking about.
Yeah, true. Look, I mean, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of travel involved, people away on you know, work trips
and
together.
They have needs.
No, I'm not. No, it's not like that. I think, to be honest, it was a weird thing because culturally it seemed to skip my generation. But the generation that came before me, some very well-known broadcasters, and I mean big, big national names, this was rampant. And so, you know, I'll cite an example because I don't want to sort of talk in code, but it's fairly well known that the broadcaster Fee Glover,
who
was at Radio 4, then at Radio 5, and now at Times Radio, had a very, very short marriage.
Is it a man or a lady?
She's
Fiona.
Fiona.
Oh, I don't know.
Fee Glover. Her marriage to Mark Sandell lasted 3 months because he was having an affair with Victoria Derbyshire. And they're now married. So, you know.
Is that the quiz of that quiz I don't like?
No, that's Victoria Corrin.
Oh.
He's married to David Mitchell.
Yeah, exactly. No.
Everyone's all interconnected. But
that was a good example. But there were loads in that generation of broadcasters, but didn't seem to happen much in my sort of decade, if you like.
Must be your influence, your sobering influence.
Not at all.
There was a fair amount of sneaking in the TV departments where I was. Not that I was ever involved with, I just have to say that in case my husband's listening. I think it's a very intense workplace, and I think that it can create really close bonds really quickly that don't actually work in the outside world when you're outside of the project. A bit more real life again. And I do wonder whether that has some element of people behaving like that and just understanding what the world is like. So I remember one of the first films I worked on, I actually hired my husband as a runner so that he would understand what it was like. So when I would phone up and say, we're still filming, I'm not going to be home, or I'm off on location, I'm not going to be contactable for however many days, he wouldn't be sat there thinking, what is she doing? She's working 14-hour days. That's what she's doing. She's not got time to do anything else. but kind of an understanding of that world. And I think that's almost why a lot of healthcare professionals end up with healthcare professionals, because they understand the pressures and the realities of that world. And I think film and TV and radio probably have an element of that as well. But it's definitely kind of looking at the intensity of workplace relationships that kind of fed into this book.
Oh, that's fascinating. Taking something from your acknowledgements, which is an area of sensitivity, I guess. But the first thing you do is to thank, and I'll quote here, the families who shared their stories of adoption and of child loss with you. Mm-hmm. that's a very tough subject to approach. I mean, how do you approach people to talk to you about that and then weave that into the way your story develops?
That's quite difficult. I started with the people that I knew that had experienced those kind of things and said, look, I'm still thinking of writing a story that has elements of this within it. The main characters, John and Anna, have been trying for a child for a long time without success. There are all kinds of elements to their past that you find out throughout the book. And like I said, you know, if I were to write this book, what should I avoid? What are the kind of misconceptions? How do you feel about that? Would you talk to me about it a little bit to see if I'm being on the mark or insensitive? And they were very generous that the people, my friends who've experienced these things, had a chat with me, and then they kind of put me in touch with other people. So it was more kind of a personal approach rather than just going, you there, you've had some trauma, talk to me about it. Because I did wonder how I was going to start, and I did kind of read lots of online forums where people had shared their experiences so I could read it at a distance to kind of get some understanding. And I did contemplate reaching out, but to be honest, my friends and then friends of friends and friends of friends were also generous that I didn't have to almost cold call people to ask them to talk to me about it, which I'm grateful for.
Yeah. And from that experience of speaking to people, is there or are there common themes that emerge or experiences that you've woven in?
I think the main one that kind of stuck out was people's insensitivity about asking. You know, why aren't you pregnant yet? When are you going to have a baby? You've been married a really long time. Where's the baby? When are you having the next one? It's just like, if people aren't having babies, it's entirely their business as to why or why not, whether it's by choice or by, you know, things not quite working out how you want. Because, you know, it's easier to not have a baby, I think, than it is to have a baby. Like, you can want to do it and everything has to align for it to happen, and for some people it doesn't align in the way that they want it to. So yeah, it was that kind of insensitivity, I think, was the main thing. People not minding their own business.
I wonder, well, that's probably what made them happy to talk about it, because it's almost like educating people through fiction. And, you know, hopefully that they will take away and think about it and think, you know, actually, someone's not pregnant, it's not necessarily that it's a choice.
Isn't it strange, though? I mean, in so many ways, society moves on quite fast in certain areas. But on this one, the childless married couple, or indeed couples, you know, basically, I'm sort of dancing around the subject, but I suppose I've got a lot of female friends for whom marriage didn't happen and kids didn't happen. And actually, they've got to that point because, you know, I'm approaching mid-50s now. They've reached that point where it's not going to happen in terms of kids. And I know a lot of them have spent the last decade, for instance, wrestling with that sense of disappointment and guilt. And I wonder how much of that element is self-generated and how much of it is societal.
Oh, that's a good question.
That's a good question. And I have to admit, as the mother of two children that I was lucky to have and to choose to have, I don't know. I think there's probably quite a lot of societal pressure for that. I certainly know that when it's almost like society immediately wants you to skip to the next step. So you meet somebody and they're like, when are you going to get engaged? And then if you do, you get engaged, and they go, when's the wedding? And then you have the wedding and they're like, when are you going to have children? And you have a child and they go, when are you going to have the next one? You're like, can you just let me do one thing at a time that it works for us?
And you know what? When they start to grow up, you get, what are they going to do? Are they going to go to university? What jobs are they going to do? Where are they going to live? And I'm like, wait a minute.
This sounds really hypocritical, because my daughter calls me the nosy writer because I'm always listening. I'm always eavesdropping. I'm kind of looking at why people do what they do and how they interact. And I got in trouble on holiday last year because I was on the beach and there was a family next to us and they were having the most spectacular argument. It was brilliant. And I was just like, I'm just gonna listen in as to what they're arguing about and why and what point. And my daughter's like, Mom, stop it. But I think people are inherently nosy. We're inherently interested in what other people are doing and why. partly because that's just the stuff of life, and partly because I think if people make the same decisions as you, it makes you feel better about your own decisions. And I think that's why a lot of people who have children are very keen to make sure that other people have children, because it any questions or insecurities they might have are kind of squashed by somebody else going, you did the right thing because I'm doing the same thing. So I think it's a whole but a whole lot of psychology around why people make the life decisions that they do. And I like to think that I've got little elements of this throughout the book to kind of drop in those kind of questions. But yeah, I mean, even down to like gender of children. When I was first found out I was having a girl, people must be like, oh, you must be so pleased you're having a girl. I'm like, yeah, girl, boy, all good. And then when I'm having a second one, they're like, oh, do you think you'll have a boy next? I'm like, just, I'm very grateful to have two healthy children. I don't really mind what gender they are. And it's amazing how some people are like, oh, you must be pleased you're having a girl. And then immediately when I had two girls, like, oh, aren't you sad you're not having a girl? You can't win.
I had the same because I had three boys, and I did have people say, oh, you must be disappointed. Third boy.
You're like, don't say that when you can hit them. I mean, it would be nice to know what it was like to have a son, but I'm happy with my two girls. They're great.
I'm going to say one word to you. Socks. That's what it's like to have sons. Socks everywhere.
You know, but what? Never in pairs.
Never in pairs. Yeah, I don't know whether girls have that issue.
This morning, I literally picked up three or four socks off my daughter's floor, and none of them matched each other. She doesn't do pairs of socks. I've stopped trying. As long as she's got one on each foot, it's fine.
I'm the same. And I see them, and they've got different coloured toes, and I just think, oh, well, they've got two socks, and that's great.
They have warm feet. That's what that tells you.
Alison, let's talk about you as the evolution of you as a writer, because, you know, this is three books in since the first one was published. So was it three in 4 years? Is that right?
Oh, it's 3 and 18 months.
Yeah. 3 and 18 months. Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. I don't know why I came that impression. Anyway, look, that's going some.
Yeah.
What have you unlocked to be that productive, or what have you learned?
Well, I mean, what's your secret?
Yeah, no, I mean, because a lot of people would struggle, I think.
What I always admit is that the Cuckoo Sister and the Silent Friend existed as a whole draft when I signed my book deal. Because when I was on submission for the Cuckoo Sister, there's literally nothing you can do. You can't control it. You can't influence it. You just have to wait while your book goes to the editors and while they have time to read it and think about it. So I did the only thing I could do, which is write another book. And The Silent Friend came out of me quite quickly, as the rough first draft anyway. And so when I signed, I had two complete books. I think if I didn't have that, I wouldn't have had time to publish them as quickly as I did. And then while The Silent Friend was, so I was editing The Silent Friend, promoting The Cuckoo Sister and drafting The New Girl. And the answer is I didn't sleep for a long time and I worked silly hard. And I worked in evenings and weekends and didn't go out to things, and my children forgot what I looked like. So I am spacing the books out a bit more now. And also I have just finished working at Cambridge Literary Festival. So I'm going to be working full time on the writing. And then I have a couple of other more writing related projects that I'm working on as well. So hopefully I'll get to sleep a bit more. But the main reason I could publish them that fast is that two of them existed.
Right.
To start with. But I have honed my writing process. There we go. It took a long time to get that work. So I kind of know what I'm doing, where I start, and I know how I work, and I understand that I just have to get the first draft out. It can be messy. There can be holes in it. That there's, for example, with The Cuckoo Sister, there was a chapter I was really struggling to write. And I felt like I spent days banging my head against a brick wall. And in the end, I just put a mental post-it note on it that said, write this chapter later, and then carried on with the rest of the book.
Yeah.
And when I got to the end of the draft and read it, I realized I didn't need that chapter. So I would have ended up cutting it anyway. So sometimes my subconscious knows better than I do what needs to go into the book and doesn't. But I mean, I distinctly remember there was a line in The Silent Friend where they're talking to a lady and she's talking about some 1970s fashion house, and I just thought, you know what, if I stop now to research which 1970s fashion house, I will lose my momentum. So it literally kind of goes blah blah blah, blah brackets, insert fashion house, blah blah blah, blah. So I didn't lose the momentum. I kept going and couldn't see it because it was a point that needed researching, but it was a very small point. It wasn't hugely relevant to the entire arc of the story. It's like I can do that in 10 minutes when I finish the draft, and I can just go back and drop it back in. So learning that I don't have to spend hours trying to find the right word in the first draft, because it is a first draft. I can come back and I look at a word and go, I know I didn't like that word first time, but I know what I meant. And now I can find a better word while I'm drafting, while I'm editing. So yeah. I think that helps as well.
As long as you don't leave that in the final book in brackets. Search fashion house.
I actually do a word search for brackets just in case.
Oh, that's good. Just in case.
No, I think
you could put the word sausage or something, and then you'd find all the sausages.
I know, it's like I live in fear of changing one of my characters' names, because I did in The New Girl. I changed the main male character's name. I was just like, boy, I hope. I said to my my proofreader, I was like, please, can you also double check that I have replaced all of them? I hate that when you kind of go replace all. Does it work?
Yeah, because that's, or if it's like a part of a word as well. So say the character was called, I don't know, Art,
yeah.
Sam and same.
Sam is a good one, yeah. And
exactly.
You go, just go, just all Sam's to Bob.
it's like I'm kind of both in awe and scared of the writers that just accept all of their proofread the changes without reading the book again. I'm like,
are there people who do that?
Apparently. They know their process works for them, no question on that. But that would terrify me.
I'm shocked by that.
I'm too much of a control freak not to kind of go, I'm just going to read it one more time.
Yeah.
I'm actually shocked that people would just accept proof marks without checking. Wow.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess if a writer, you've read it 40 times, you'd be like, but now I'm a control freak, I have to read it. It's still the type of...
Interesting, the emphasis that, you know, of putting that research aside for a later date is all in the service of flow and progress and in the manuscript. And I must admit that you know, with the way my brain works, is that if I'll get to some point where I need to know what sort of brand of cigarette my character in 1940 would be smoking, because I'm looking for a sophisticated brand that would be rare, need to be smuggled in from somewhere.
Well,
and that has totally stymied me thus far.
I'm also working on historical fiction, and actually when I signed with my agent, I was in the middle of a draft of a historical fiction novel that has 25,000 words in it, and a come back to me later while the contemporary books are taking off. But I had a really lovely chat with Laura Shepherd Robinson, because I was completely overwhelmed with the historical research. And like, where do you stop? Like, when do you stop and when do you start writing? And she was saying that what she does is take and forgive me, Laura, if I'm misrepresenting this, but to take an overarching look at where the novel is set and what the period is and what you're looking at, and make sure you read cover to cover a book that really covers that. So for example, my book was 18th century London and 18th century Australia. So I had one book on 18th century London, one book on 18th century Australia, and read them cover to cover, which gives you like a general view. And then when you write your first draft, you know which elements you need to go back and research. So what cigarettes would have been smoking. And actually I spoke with a fascinating fashion historian who was telling me about how like stockings were repaired and how shoes in that time period were consumables. They weren't expected to last for long. They were fixed repeatedly or replaced. So which is why when you have people going out on ships across the world, they took literally like cases full of shoes, because shoes didn't last forever, and you wouldn't have had a shoe repairer or a shoemaker in the colony. So you needed to take like a vat of shoes with you. And then you can go back and when you're doing your editing, drop in those little bits that you now know that you need in that specific area. Because otherwise you could research for years and years and years and years and years and years and years, with lots of fascinating stuff that will never make it into the book. And I kind of like that kind of two-tier level of research. So I know generally what I want to say, where I want to go. And then I, specific 70s French fashion houses or types of cigarette are a second draft targeted research.
Mm.
Brackets. Bracket research.
With the brackets. Yeah.
With the brackets. Yeah.
Just briefly touching on your process then, at what stage does the manuscript go to Emily Yao, your editor?
So generally I do a first draft, which is scrappy, and then I go through that again and give that kind of almost a demi edit, depending on how scrappy the first draft is and how happy I'm with it. That then goes off to my editor, to my agent rather, Marianne. She reads it and I see if her comments and my comments are similar. And then if we're happy that it's ready to go to Emily, and that the changes are not, you know, catastrophic, I will write an edit letter kind of going, I think I need to do this and this and this and this and this and this, and this needs changing and that needs tweaking. And what do you think about this character? And then send it to Emily. And then she reads it and gets her ideas. And then we combine all of those. And then Emily does me a broad strokes structural edit. And then we go from there. So Emily gets kind of second/third draft. Mm. Yeah. In an ideal world, I'd probably like time to do another one, but I'm not sure that would actually be much more productive. I don't know, because I might spend time changing things that then Emily would come back and say, no, let's do this.
Yeah, why did you change
that? I'm fascinated in the sense that you're communicating at that stage rather than just sort of letting the editor, right, take the text as is and making their own interpretations. In the sense, you're flagging up the things that you think could do with...
And I need to double check this with Emily, that she doesn't read my edit notes until she's made her own.
Ah, okay.
So she's got them.
That makes sense. I think I'd be the same, actually. Because you want to then compare to see, almost to sort of validate what you think and see if there's,
just... So I think she does read it blind as such. And then, kind of combines all of the suggestions as to what to be changed. So the new girl... The main changes were with the timing of various twists, the kind of one getting forward, one getting just to help with the pacing, try and pull the reader into the story faster, which I'm at the stage with my fourth book now, kind of going, right, where am I going to put that? And I was thinking this morning, I'm going to bring it forward, because actually in every book so far, the edit response has been bring it forward. So just going to start by doing that.
Well, that leads me on to my next point, which is, given that you've had the experience now of three books out in the world and working on the fourth, I suppose my question is reader feedback. How much is that now playing into the way that you approach a project? Are you conscious of things that people have said to you?
To some extent. I think the main issue is that the reader feedback is by its very nature contradictory. So what some people will love, some people will hate. And literally for the first book, I just got two new reviews that I had a look, because I am terrible. I do look at reviews, I do read them. But I feel it's kind of like market research, knowing what your readers are thinking. If they're all saying the same kind of thing, then maybe that's something that could do with tweaking. One of them gave it a 1-star. And one of them gave it a 5-star for exactly the same reason. So it's like, you can't please everybody.
No.
I think little bits of it kind of come into mind to kind of see what's really worked, or if there's something that really hasn't worked. But the main feedback that people didn't like about the first book was they disagreed with the ending. But I actually wrote the alternative ending to see, because I was aware it was a bit like, could go this way, that way. And I wrote the original ending and thought, that's going to annoy some people. Let's have a look at the other ending. And then decided, now I'll stick with the first ending. So I'll stand by that. And I think the main feedback is that I create characters that are infuriating. And I take that as a compliment, because, I mean, to be fair, actually most of the people saying that have said it like, oh, they're so annoying, it was great, I wanted to throw things at them or shout at them through the pages. But I'm like, if you're getting that kind of emotional response from a reader, I feel like I'm doing something right. And I love characters like that you just kind of go, what are you doing, why are you doing that, stop it now, because it means that you're emotionally engaged with what they're doing, and that's kind of my goal. So
you want that emotional response.
I don't want people to read the book and go, whatever.
Some things happened, but I wasn't engaged. I mean, engagement is everything.
And wanting to know what's going to happen as well. It's that sort of urge to, you're infuriated by the person, but you need to know whether either they get their comeuppance or they see the light, you know, they see sense or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah.
You have to know.
I do love comeuppance. The control of variety, like, you're going to pay for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then my grandma used to say that. She'd say, they're going to get their comeuppance.
Yeah.
And originally I thought it was like a gift, you know. Oh, what's their comeuppance?
More like inheritance. Here's your inheritance. Here's your comeuppance.
Yeah. I'm interested. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, you're moving on from working with the Cambridge Literary Festival and focusing full-time on writing. Is there in your mind, any sort of sense of danger that you won't have that breadth of contact with the sort of the work world and other people?
There is that, but I have to admit that it's been a lovely bookie bubble to be working as a writer and working for a literary festival. So I'm not sure from that point of view that it will make a difference. But also I have two children, I'm out on the school run. There are other elements to my life and things that I have to do, which is part of the reason that I've kind of run out of time to do the books and the other job. The theory that two part-time jobs equal one full-time job didn't work, because both of them are slightly more than part-time jobs, plus children, plus family commitments. See the comment about not sleeping. But also there are other elements that I'm kind of bringing in that I've not been able to do because I've had another job. So I will be doing other more writing related elements that aren't writing. But, you know, having always been a freelancer in film and television, I think it feels now like a good time to go back to that kind of freelancing setup, but in publishing. So, yeah, I'm excited. But I'm always out in the world. And as my daughter will tell you, as I said earlier, listening, watching what people are doing in the street, in the shops, in the supermarket. You know, one of the joys of writing in cafes is that you can sit there and observe. I mean, like, I used to commute to London and I loved the tube, even in its awfulness. Because of the people on it and what they do and the conversations that they have and what they're talking about and arguing about and how people hold themselves. And I just get out in the world and have a look at people.
I'm
like being a magpie, isn't it? Sort of picking.
Now you're in Cambridge, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've this is a very local kind of question because, you know, as you know, I'm originally from Cambridge. I wanted to know, okay, if you were to pick any of the cafes, which one is the one that provides you the best
Cambridge cafe?
Yeah, the best setting for writing and for eavesdropping.
Oh, that's hard because there are some really good cafes in Cambridge.
Yeah.
I did write part of the Cuckoo Sister in the Waterstones cafe on the second floor. and that's lovely because you can look out the window over onto Hobson Street and kind of see the students coming and going, and there's a large turnover of people. So although I generally from a cafe experience and a coffee drinking experience tend to go for the smaller cafes, I think somewhere big like the Waterstones cafe or I don't know, John Lewis's cafe or something is great.
Oh yes, that's got that panoramic view. When they revamped it, it's all glass view over Emmanuel and stuff like that.
It's also quite easy to blend yourself, because I don't know if you've ever heard of invisibility cloak syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Which is when people who like people watching forget that they're being watched. You feel invisible, like you're wearing an invisible cloak, because you're sat there thinking, oh, look, that couple over there, they're going in a book, and all. You don't know that someone over there might be a writer and looking at you and thinking, oh, that lady, she's looking around a lot. She's coming in, she's going in my book.
You know what? I've always had a thing. Whenever I'm in cafes or restaurants or bars, I always like sitting in the chair with my back to the wall. And I do wonder if that's part of knowing that, people are observing. I like to observe from a place where fewer people can observe me observing, and I do wonder if it's that. I don't like having my back to the room. But it would be amusing if there's like a little chain of writers and we're all putting each other in each other's books. Like a circle.
Cambridge though, probably other writers are doing exactly
I think Cambridge is one of those wonderful places where there's a lot of intelligent people who are completely unself-aware. And so you, you overhear very passionate and quite loud conversations, mm-hmm. as if everybody within that conversation is in their bubble. It's one of those weird places where, and this is my observation from working in, you know, when I was a teenager in M&S or Heifers or whatever it was, where, you know, there would be the most extraordinary middle class intellectual conversations going on. Particularly somewhere like Heifers, where people would argue over the particular edition that they were thumbing and going, oh, no, we don't want that one. No, 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 no. The fifth's far better, superior to the sixth. You know, I don't know what they did with it. And I just used to, and you would not hear that. And you know, I dare say where
Oxford
we are.
You did.
Well, yeah, but not on the streets of Stafford.
Well, no, maybe not, but maybe we should start that. Yeah, we'll go to Waterstones and Stafford and say, oh, no, this is the fourth edition. No, no, this is terrible.
There is a definite Cambridge eavesdropping that has an academic vibe to it. And just people who just walk around talking as if they're in their own living room. But it's fascinating. Love it.
Yeah, and I think actually when you take the intellectual, the people from the university, and I don't know if this generation is dying out now, but I can certainly think of people who I used to know who from my parents' generation in their 80s and 90s now, who used to go into what they would describe as a town environment. So a shop like M&S or whatever, and just can be completely unable to cope with the proximity of ordinary people.
You're like that in Waitrose.
I am a bit like that in Waitrose, yeah. Yeah, I've seen myself.
I used to work in Marks and Spencer's when I was a teenager, and I don't recall that. I do remember people who thought that buying their groceries in Marks and Spencer's meant that they didn't have to be polite to people.
Yes, there was definitely a lot of that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I remember the lady who on like 3 o'clock on Christmas Eve was enraged that we had run out of Christmas puddings. And was just utterly convinced it was our fault for poor stock control and had a little bit of a tantrum about it. Although now I'm older and I now do Christmas at my house, I can understand that if you suddenly realise you've forgotten a key element of Christmas dinner and you can't fix it, that you might get slightly out of proportion about it. Although to be fair, at my house, I'm like, it doesn't really, like Christmas is lovely, but I'm not going to stress about whether we have the right, I don't know, Christmas pudding or whether, you know, we've got 17 different types of vegetable on the table, because actually that's not fun and Christmas is supposed to be fun.
Yeah, it's not fun for the person in charge of everything, is it?
No. My kids will.
You're getting baked beans with your turkey. You're going to enjoy it.
What was that lockdown Christmas I did say to our kids, because it was just us, like, what do you want? Like, if you want to have pizza and chocolate pudding, well, then we'll do that. But it turns out that my kids really like roast potatoes and pigs in blankets. So they were happy.
It's kind of a tradition, isn't it? I think they like that tradition.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, look, we've reached that point already.
Yes.
Where we delve into, I don't know how people feel about facing a second Rebecca's random question.
I can't remember my random question was last time.
I remember this morning the random question. I'm like, I'm ready. I've had my coffee. Let's do it.
Good, good, good. Well, here we go then. Rebecca's random question.
Okay, so this is a question I asked my boys on the way to school the other day, because when I drive them to school, we often talk about all sorts of things. I think, well, they tolerate it. I'm not sure how much they like it. And I said, what's your favourite shape? And neither of them could come up with one. And I thought, everybody has a favourite shape, don't they? So that's my question to you. What's your favourite shape?
Oh, that's a great question. I know. Ooh, I'm kind of going, it's not triangle. I know it's not triangle. I think it's either like a shell shape, because there's something really beautiful and tactile about that kind of curve with the dip in it, and you get those gorgeous, is it the Fibonacci spirals in some shells? Or dodecahedron, because the word is awesome.
I like that. There we go.
Shell or dodecahedron.
two different shapes as well.
I know. What's your favourite shape?
Well, I love this is a weird one. I don't know how to describe it. I don't. There is probably a technical term for it. But I'm thinking lozenge shape in the sense of...
Oh, there is a technical...
Sort of rectangular with curved ends.
Yeah.
So I think some, sweets used to be like that. But I'm always drawn to a badge in that shape. Mm-hmm. If someone's got a lapel badge with that sort of...
lozenge shape.
Yeah.
That is the technical term. Isn't that a cut of diamond called the lozenge, that shape as well?
Quite possibly.
Actually, it might be, yeah.
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 Well, I think it's called a Mobius strip.
Actually, to me, that's a band.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, I don't know. It's sort of a shape. What? It's a shape what? As well. But what I like the fact that it does. It's impossible to imagine, but it does exist.
I'm going to have to Google that now. What shape is Mobius?
Thousands of people listening to
this. Like the infinity. It's like the infinity shape, but it's 3D.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. No, that's a good shape. Yeah.
But I did quite like a circle too.
Classic. Can't go wrong with that. Mm. I have to admit, my favourite version of that, whenever I meet grown-ups or children, the great question is, what's your favourite dinosaur? Because children often have a favourite dinosaur. It's a really great way to start a conversation. And it gives you an idea of what kind of adult you're talking to if they look at you like you're insane or go, oh, I do love a triceratops. Which, for the record, is one of my two favourite dinosaurs, along with the Diplodocus.
Oh, I don't know, actually. I quite like the flying thing.
Pterodactyl.
The names.
Pterodactyl.
The flying thing with big wings.
Yeah,
a pterodactyl.
Yeah.
Which is also one of my favourite jokes that my daughter tells me. Am I allowed to tell a slightly
go on
joke?
Then
why can you not tell when the pterodactyl goes to the toilet?
I don't know because why can has, you
because it has a silent pee.
Oh,
oh
yeah,
that's good.
And for the record, mine's iguanodon because it always used to go around like this, looking like a sort of prehistoric Paul McCartney.
Thumbs up.
Brilliant.
Well,
look, it's been an absolute pleasure, and it's lovely to catch up with you and you know, discuss the evolution, but also the
talking sort of, to dinosaurs.
Yeah. the way you approach your writing and your thought process is very, very inspiring, actually. Mm. So, Alison, thank you.
Well, that's good. Thank you, because I'm about to go and stare into the abyss of a spreadsheet for four, because I'm looking at tweaking the structure.
Oh, gosh.
Well, we wish you all the luck with that. Perhaps
you.
The random question wasn't as tough as what's facing you.
Yes, but those spreadsheets will be easy after the random question. Oh, you always big it up. It's not that difficult.
Just create cells with lozenge shape.
You don't like spreadsheets, do you?
God.
No.
I'm an events coordinator and a writer. Yeah, I'm a spreadsheeter.
Yeah, I do. I love them. And I've just discovered Asana, which is like a project management. I love it.
It's brilliant.
Well, on that note, positive note, and a big plug for Asana. Alison Stockham, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I don't know where you get your random questions from sometimes.
My head.
Hmm. What does that say about your head?
That it's weird.
Fair enough.
Or Toby.
Yeah.
Sometimes he makes suggestions. I think the one I remember was, if you were a tree, what tree would you be? That came from Toby.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much to Alison Stockham. Who's our guest next week?
Our guest next week is a lady called Amanda Marples, who has no connection with crime fiction. So I came across her because I was a structural editor for her book called Student Self-Care, published by Summersdale, which is part of Hachette. And during our conversations while I was editing her book, I said, oh, we do a podcast. And so she's coming on. So she has her own business. She also works in universities, but she has her own business, which helps neurodiverse people with writing. So it's like a sort of a coaching service for neurodiverse writers. So that's the point of interest for us.
In what regard?
Look at me like that.
Yeah, look at me. Well, you know, we talked about it plenty of times. So I've got,
but it's not just that. It's a lot of the people we've interviewed, a lot of the writers we've interviewed have said, oh, and by the way, I also have ADHD, or I've just been diagnosed with ADHD. More percentage-wise than the general population.
Absolutely.
So it is a thing in the creative industries, for
Very
sure.
Much so. Very much so.
Be interested to see what Amanda has to say about that. Because she also has ADHD herself. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, totally. You've had a very emotional week.
Oh, God, don't set me off. I have, yes. Yeah. So middle son, Josh, had his last day at sixth form on Friday. And I didn't expect to participate in any way, really, because when you get to senior school, you don't have the little graduation with the, you know, like they do for nursery and things like that. But he won a prize. So as a parent, I was invited to the prize giving part of the day, which was the sort of first assembly they had. And not only that, so he won an art prize, which is just it's given every year. Somebody in year 11 gets it, and somebody in year 13. And he got the year 13. But he also got a school colour, which I think unless you've been to private school, this isn't a private school, I hear in Strad, but
it's a grammar school.
Yeah, but they have colours at private school?
Yeah. I mean, I got mine for playing hockey or something. But
yeah, so they're normally given to students who've achieved in some field or other, often sport or music or academics or leadership. And Josh got one. Now, he's not sporty, he's not particularly musical, and he's not a leader. But he was given his colour for sort of the a level of development he's experienced over the 7 years and just sort of little contributions he's made. So in terms of the annual musical production at the end of the year, he runs a Quibble Society, which is like a sort of history club. And he's done lots of graphic design for the Quibble Society and also just his art in general. So
yeah,
that made his day, I think. I mean, the when his name was called out as one of the people who got a colour, he didn't know about this. It was a complete surprise. I didn't know either. It was lovely. It was, and yes, I did cry on Friday.
Yeah, I mean, colours tend to be given to the sporting superstars and the confident, outspoken pupils who contribute. Whereas Josh would never be that. He's as they put it, very polite, but very considered and in the interests that he's got. He is a leader in a way, but in a very quiet way.
And in fact, the head boy gave his speech, he said that there are quite a few quiet heroes in the upper sixth. And I think that is what Josh is, you know, these sort of people who they do a lot. They have a big impact on their peers and their youngers, but in a very quiet way without them even realising they're doing it.
Well, I hope it gives him, you know, as he approaches his A-levels now, the actual exams, he's done his art practical already, but the academic, and he's got he's doing four A-levels, so he's got a big old summer ahead. But as he approaches the next stage of his life, then I'm sure this will give him, you know, confidence that his way can bring, you know, a degree of recognition. And it's a credit to the school that they spot that and exploit that. I mean, I remember when I was at, because I was solidly sporty, but not great, never very good at it, but always in the teams, because, you know, they just needed to make the numbers up or whatever. Just about sort of scraped my way into the teams for rugby and hockey and whatever. But I would do lots of other things around the fringes. And I remember when I was leaving it was a prep school, fee-paying prep school, at the age of 11. To my surprise, I was given this enormous cup called the Tobin Trophy. And that was for the biggest contribution to school life.
Yes, they actually did have prizes for that contribution to school life.
Well, and what it was that, I mean, I had all my closest friends were some of the brightest people and the, you know, professors at Oxford now and stuff like that. And they would always be trusted with, for instance, re-indexing the library.
But by,
what a fun job.
Well, they were invited to do this, and we gave up all our break. Well, they gave up their break times, but because they were my mates, what else was I going to do? I mean, I was suddenly on my own. So I threw myself whole heart and soul, volunteered, can I join in? And so that was one thing that got me this prize, was that because, you know, really, it was my peer group who were the ones who were trusted to take on these leadership roles. But because, you know, by default, suddenly I'm left alone in the playground, I joined in. But that was recognised by the staff that I was, you know, a willing player, if you like, in all sorts of things which are otherwise quite dull. But it still means a great deal to me even now when I think about it. You know, 43 years on or something. It was a hell of a thing, because I didn't expect it at all.
Yeah, so similar to Josh.
And it was the last prize given out at prize giving. And it was a whopping great. It was like the FA Cup. It was huge. I didn't look after it terribly well. I didn't realise that you had to polish these things. But yeah. But congratulations to Josh. So it's been a sort of emotional week for you, really has. And I have to give you credit. I mean, you are working beyond tolerant levels, really, at the moment, because, you know, you've got a lot on your plate. And so have I, but nothing like your workload at the moment. I don't know how you keep going.
I don't know. I think I'm making up for it this weekend. But yes, I was up at 6 and going to bed turning the laptop off at 11 last week every day.
Yeah.
It's just a very busy time, and it's coincidence more than anything else. So the work for Oxford University Press, we talked about the big freeze they had. The big freeze thawed out, and of course that meant that there's a backlog of stuff. And all very positive work, just a lot of it. So, you know, we published a lot of books in April coming into May, more than we normally would. We've got two Kindle 99 price deals going on at the moment. So R.D. Nixon's Crossfire is currently 99p 99 cents, and also Rachel Sargent's Her Deadly Friend is still 99p. It's not in America, but it is in the UK. So, you know, there's a lot of things associated with that. We published The Midnight Man last week, which without going into too much detail, we've had printer issues all the way through with that book, ongoing this week as well. So a lot of sort of running around. And you know when everything is telling you it's urgent, and that last week was a good case of that. I had lots of things and people saying, this job is urgent, so this is the one you need to focus on. Well, when you have four or five of those at the same time, it's impossible to choose. It really is.
Yeah, and you see, the debate I have is, you know, one person's urgent is, I mean, in the context of the things you were dealing with, you know, it's difficult, because for the person who's contacting you, say, this is urgent, it is urgent.
Yes, it's absolutely urgent to that person.
Yes.
And
But you know, it was difficult to sort of watch you being bounced around quite to that extent. And yes, there were things that really needed attention and sorting out. But it is difficult. I think that one of the challenges in this job is to, I mean, clearly you want to resolve things as fast as possible. Mm. But at the same time, you know, I think that it's very difficult for people to understand that there are other things going on in the world and within your life that also impact on your availability.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's also been a week of taking people to various medical appointments and things like that. So when I was taking my mum to the doctor, the Midnight Man thing was going on, and it was quite hard. Sat in the car with my laptop on the lap while my mother was in the doctor's and emailing Clays saying, oh, you need to sort this out. And it is difficult. It's difficult. I mean, you know, but you just do the best you can, as quick as you can. For everybody, whether they're grandmother, Grandma Bertie, as I call her, or one of our authors, or whatever, or you.
Indeed. We had a chance to just break away from work, and so we'd like to thank very much Marguerite and Gert for taking us out for lunch in Ironbridge this week. Two big fans of the podcast.
That was lovely. And thank you for the strawberry waffle.
Yes, which the boys have loved.
And Toby especially.
And quietly, even though I'm supposed to be on a low-carb diet, I've had a couple.
And I've raised an eyebrow at you when you
have. Yes, that's as much as you're prepared to, well, you know, I won't let you raise any more than an eyebrow when I'm breaking the rules. But lovely they were, and lovely to see you. We'd like to, from the Hoback community point of view, wish Robert Dawes a happy birthday this weekend.
Oh, is it Robert Dawes' birthday?
It is, yeah.
Oh, I need to make him a little video then.
You do, you do.
I hope it's today.
I think they were celebrating yesterday.
Oh, I'll check.
Anyway, Uncle Bob, happy
May
birthday.
The 4th.
Yes, that's right. Well, the week ahead is looking just as bonkers, I think.
Well, we've got a bank holiday. Bank holidays for me are catch-up days.
Yes.
So, yes.
You don't stop working. I mean, that's the important thing.
No, I catch up on a Monday. Yes. On a bank holiday Monday.
It is going to allow us both to catch up on a number of projects.
It's like the Queen, the day of the Queen's funeral and the coronation. It was fantastic. We had so many bank holidays last year. So many catch-up days for me.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But would that it won't have to be that way, you know, that you could actually take some time off, but it's not the nature of things. And I have to say that I'm a little bit aggrieved with you know, now that spring has arrived, I mean, it's a beautiful day, the pollen's up, and I don't usually suffer from hay fever, but at the moment, my ability to do audiobooks is somewhat curtailed by the fact that I've got a streaming nose, my eyes are watering, and I've got a tickle at the back of the throat and a cough, and it's not a virus, it's blinking hay fever.
Yeah.
And it's making it very difficult. I did some recording yesterday, and it was an absolute chore because I was getting to the middle of sentences and then starting to feel that constriction of a cough coming or a sneeze, having to, you know, pause the recording and then pick up again. And it was just, you know, recording is interruptus or whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
It wasn't great.
Recordus interruptus, indeed. And then we're going to the Canal Festival shortly, aren't we, too?
Yes. Yeah, so Norbury, where we are, this is Norbury Junction, is a big canal junction, as the name suggests. And each year, each May, for the first bank holiday, they have a canal festival, which is, as you'd expect, a lot of narrow boats from all over the country arrive, quite a few of them historic working boats. A lot of the crafts that are done by people who own boats, so they're up for sale. We're going to go for a coffee because there's a woman who's put the stern of her boat. She's got a full barista coffee set up, fantastic machine. And so we fancy a coffee, a little wander over there. And it's an opportunity for the Canals and River Trust to try and raise some money as well, which they desperately need because so much of the network needs work. You know, it's incredibly expensive to replace lock gates, for instance, but they do need replacing occasionally. They have to drain them out and they take months sorting them out.
Mm.
Or indeed, if you've, you know, ever walk a canal path and during the winter, they can become exceptionally unpleasant muddy, mainly because, you know, they haven't got the money to go and repair the paths and put down proper hard standing and, you know, hardcore to try and improve the condition of them. So it's a worthy cause, and it's a great little sort of very British slice of life.
Yes, and lots of sort of outsider art, examples of outsider art, as it's called, which is like sort of folkish art.
Yes.
But great, great creativity, actually.
Yeah.
And it does make you feel a sort of sense of pride in our cultural heritage, I think.
Absolutely.
It's like Morris dancers.
Yes, you love those, don't you? Absolutely. Right, well, thank you for joining us. Join us again next week for the Hofcast Book Show. If you want to check out anything about Hoback Books, then check out our website, www.hoback.net, for all details there of our authors, our books, audiobooks, the lot. It's all there. But from myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins.
Thank you for joining us, and we'll look forward to speaking to you after, we hope, a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hoback Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.